Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Innovations often seem nuts before they seem necessary. And there's an unusual band of inventors pushing to improve our bodies and our gadgets in ways you may never have thought about. But the movies have.
What are your prime directives?
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room.
You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work.
What's going on? John?
Eva?
No. John.
Even with all these new abilities, there are dangers. Man may be able to evolve a thousandfold through this technology, but the rush must be tempered with wisdom.
Stephen Kotler is the author of Tomorrowland, our journey from science fiction to science fact. And he says that art has done a lot to create the world we live in today and the one we'll live in tomorrow. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Why do you think that it is just now that we're starting to make these breakthroughs that feel, in a lot of ways, like science fiction, like they couldn't possibly really be happening?
It's an interesting question. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that technology, and this is kind of Ray Kurzweil's work, he figured out that as technology becomes information technology, meaning you can take that technology and translate it into the ones and zeros of computer code, that technology hops on an exponential growth curve. So it starts doubling. And Moore's law is the classic example, right? It says essentially that every 18 months or so, your computers stay the same price, but they get twice as powerful. Well, this same performance curve is showing up in dozens of technologies. Biotech is a great example. It's now moving at five times the speed of Moore's law, meaning it's doubling in power every 4 months. So this stuff has been going on for a long time, right? It's been very incremental, little bit, but it's accelerating. So much is bubbling up to the surface now that we're really starting to see, you know, science fiction turning into science fact.
When you talk to inventors, to scientists, what do you hear in terms of the effect of actually watching like a Star Trek or Star Wars or reading Ray Bradbury novels? How much does that shape what they're trying to do?
I think, first of all, absolutely, this stuff is inspiring scientists, and it always has. I also think, and we kind of know this from the human performance literature, that if you want to bring that, you got to be able to hold the impossible in your head and your imagination before you can bring it into reality. And it's easier to go where we can see. And so I think, you know, some of it is we're kind of hedging our bets. Some of it's inspiration. Some of it's you go where you look.
So there is this connection then between, in some ways, fiction and reality.
I think very, very strongly. For example, in Tomorrowland, I spent a little bit of time on bionics. If you talk to the people at the forefront of bionics, they all saw the $6 million man.
Right.
Right? They all were inspired by we can rebuild him, we can make him better, stronger, right? That it was too pervasive in the culture, you know, if you were growing up in the 70s and the 80s, to miss. So, you know, it had a big impact.
You also talk to people who are working on flying cars, even flying motorcycles. Why are they doing it? And where does that drive to do something that I don't know that it's going to have any big impact anytime soon on our actual, you know, transportation infrastructure? Where does that drive come from?
I think, for starters, it comes from Blade Runner. And you might be laughing, but I mean, so many people of my, you know, my generation saw Blade Runner and went, okay, flying cars, I really want one. Or saw the Jetsons, flying cars, I really want one. And, you know, the history of flying cars, by the way, goes all the way back. We've almost got 100 years of developmental history. What's different now is that Desjardins Molnar, not only he built a flying motorcycle, it really does fly, and it's affordable for the masses, right? He's actually the patents are now open sourced, and he is about to start producing a kit so anybody can snap these things together and actually do it. He doesn't think this is not like the Lexus. It's not going to replace, you know, mom driving the kids to school. This is a flying car for guys who ride ninja motorcycles. It's a niche, but it's a fairly large niche, and it's here today.
Now, I sort of can't imagine that people are going to be flying cars or riding in flying cars without serious problems, serious complaints to the FAA or whoever you make your complaint to about a flying car. I mean, do you really see in 20, 30 years that there's going to be, just like some people have motorcycles now or some people have Lamborghinis, like not everybody has them, but there will be people flying around with flying cars?
I think whether it's flying cars or drones, I think we are in for 30 years of, you know, deep, serious, complicated, who owns aerospace and how can we use it, you know, discussion. So clearly that is coming. Clearly you're correct. Is it, you know, it also depends on, you know, if Elon Musk's Hyperloop comes into development and suddenly I can take a train and Las Vegas is now in the backyard of Los Angeles, that may diminish our need for flying cars, right? Other innovations may come along that, you know, are faster, better, stronger. But there's always going to be, I think, recreational hobbyists. I was joking with Desher and I was like, look, you know, these are great. Make one that carries my surfboard. Make one that carries my mountain bike. And, you know, my hour and a half commute to the mountains to go skiing, I will happily turn that into 20 minutes, right? So I think there is absolutely a recreational market. I think there's a market to serve action and adventure sport athletes. He was thinking really in terms of emergencies. How do you evacuate a city if, you know, Katrina happens, things along those lines, right? We need more options than just these single-lane roads in the face of hurricanes. So there's a lot of splinter developments that are slightly outside the mainstream where you start to say, oh, okay, I can see how, you know, it's worth it for the FAA to start having these discussions and why these things could be useful.
Well, let me ask you actually about Elon Musk's Hyperloop because, you know, in some ways, that is something, that idea that you could go from like one end of California to the other in a matter of minutes, it's so surreal. You know, you talk about this with science fiction. Can you imagine that something like that will be viewed as normal in a few decades that we currently view as just, you know, it would be in a movie?
When it comes to the Hyperloop, I think it sounds like this absolutely fantastic transportation system, which it is. But when we get bedazzled by it, what we forget is it's literally going to change the way neighborhoods are formed. It's going to change the way cities function. It could, we know, for example, and this is work that came out of the Santa Fe Institute, that as population density in cities go up, innovations go up. It's because ideas bump into each other and people can collaborate in new ways. The Hyperloop suddenly opens up all kinds of new interesting collaborative possibilities. It opens up all kinds of new social possibilities. If you're living in Cleveland, Ohio, suddenly you can start your dating pool just, you know, expanded into Pennsylvania.
Right.
Right? It sounds funny, but these are really, like, these are the fundamental changes that are going to come and they're going to shift things. We think we're kind of living in one world now, but transportation is obviously the limiting factor. Something like the Hyperloop, that really starts to change that.
When you look at this whole set of cutting-edge technologies, what is the rationale for the people who work on them? Is it a monetary rationale, or is this mostly people, Elon Musk as an example, you know, who have a ton of money, and this is sort of their play idea, and they're trying to make it happen?
Well, it's interesting because I think the Elon Musks of the world are rare. I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, inventors with tons of money who are driving this stuff forward. We're certainly seeing that with life extension, with Google getting in the mix and things like that. But if you, you know, I looked at 16 different technologies really close up in Tomorrowland, and I would say 12, 13 of them are being driven forward by kind of really maverick inventors. And it's people who have a very serious DIY ethos. And where you were right is they are playing. That's a lot of the difference here, is a lot of this kind of starts off in a weird way with play. Like, for example, the future of bionics, right? The creator of the world's first bionic ankle is a guy named Yu Hare. He's the head of MIT's biomechatronics lab. And Yu, when he was younger, was a brilliant world champion level rock climber and lost both of his legs below the knees in a mountaineering accident when he was 19. He originally started out in his high school, 17. He was in his high school machine shop customizing prosthetic limbs for climbing for himself because he wanted to keep climbing. So he was like building beveled feet that could fit in cracks so he could keep rock climbing. Wow. As he was doing this, it dawned on him. He said, you know what? I'm not disabled. Technology is disabled. And he got obsessed. Well, that obsession, right, that I wanted to make this thing that helped me play more, over years turned into the world's first bionic limb. And, you know, I spent some time with Major David Rozelle, who's the world's first bionic soldier. And he was wearing this bionic ankle, and we were in Colorado visiting. We were walking around the campus of the University of Colorado. There were a couple of friends with us, and we came to a four-lane street. And there was snow on the ground. It was raining that day, and there was heavy traffic. And the three able-bodied people stop at the edge of the street, right? Because there's a lot of traffic.
Right.
And David Rozelle is like lost in conversation, doesn't know what he's doing, and literally like goes Walter Payton across the street, like hops across the first lane, stops, freezes, two cars go by, he dashes across that, leaps a snowbank, and like doesn't even know he's done it. And he's on the world's first bionic limb. So when we talk about these things, they're robust. And it's only a tiny window into what's coming right now today. 50% of the human body is replaceable with bionics.
Wow. So tell me what you've got your eye on, or who you've got your eye on for, you know, something you think is next, something you think we should all sort of, you know, be attuned to.
Absolutely. To me, I think what's coming next, I think over the next kind of 3 to 5 years, we're going to really see virtual reality explode. And what I mean by that is there's a bunch of different drivers here. And the first thing you need to know is I think there's probably an internet-sized opportunity inside of virtual reality. So I think there's going to be a huge economic engine driving this forward. And I think, you know, as we start to lose some jobs in the quote-unquote real world here, I think they may start moving into the virtual world, which I think will drive this. When I say there's a huge economic driver, all you have to do is go back to Second Life. In the 90s, Business Week put a guy on the cover who was the first Second Life millionaire, meaning he earned $1 million simply by building businesses inside of Second Life. So we know there's an economic engine in there. We also know the technology is getting much more robust, the interfaces and things like that. Those are all moving on exponential growth curves. So what this means is that within a period of time, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, we are going to have virtual experiences that are as meaningful and as fun as real world experiences. And that's where things start to get really interesting, because that means, you know, there's been obviously a lot of science fiction written about this. But, you know, what starts happening is people start voluntarily jacking themselves into the Matrix and not coming back. And you see this today in Japan with certain people, you know, in Korea, where they're jacked into video games and they don't want to live in reality anymore. And that's, you know, a minorly addictive game in comparison to what's coming and what's about to be neurobiologically possible. So I think virtual reality is one of the things that I think is going to be – first of all, I think economics are going to drive us in there. And I think, you know, kind of these weird addictive behaviors, meaningful behaviors, however you want to look at it, is going to keep us there. And I think that's a sizable, significant shift that's right around the corner.
Wow. Stephen Kotler is the author of Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. Stephen Kotler, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.